I originally recorded this episode with Max in 2022. I was on a borrowed laptop, which within a month of recording this died. And everything was unrecoverable from there. I didn't know what to do with it. I knew this episode existed, and it really broke my heart to have lost it. I had the laptop repaired. And this episode is back. So I'm pretty stoked. I'm not entirely sure what's on it. I'm excited for the listen as I edit it. But I'm happy to see it's going to go live. And it's hilarious that this podcast has been so quiet for 3 years. I don't know if I feel more invigorated or if I will relaunch it, but for the meantime, enjoy this final episode with Max.
That's nice AI voice. when you were like, oh, well, we can talk RPGs. And I was like, that's not really my strength, but I am very interested in it.
Yeah. I mean, we can talk about anything. I have 17 million creative pursuits. So,
and so this is that's a good thing, actually. So I'll try to get and stay in front of my mic. Can't sell this went into such a long hiatus that I struggle with maintaining any kind of interest. I think because of the fact that I allow myself to be perpetually distracted by new ideas, that I drop old ones, or the old ones stay as important as the new ones. Even if I'm not doing anything with them, they're still in the back of my mind. My wife and I were talking about it today, and I said, you know, the issue is, in a lot of cases, is I don't know whether or not I'm making progress on anything because I'm progressing on everything. And it's such a slow thing that it, you know, there has to be something very major for me to feel like I've made progress.
Yeah. Also, like, what is progress? I mean, I'm the same, but also I often struggle with, like, what feels like a valuable progress to me? Right? Because, and I'm trying to be more forgiving generally of what I identify that is, because, like, I don't know, I'm sure this is a thing that you know, but, like, I just found that linking my creative passions to my paycheck meant that valuable progress literally was just dollar signs for a long time. And then all of a sudden I hated it.
Yes. And yeah, I think the other issue that I had was I had very different views of what the podcast was, well, in terms of the podcast, what the podcast was for, than my co-host. And so when we started hosting separately, it was a lot easier because I no longer had to do this show businessy kind of thing that he had in his mind that we wanted to do. And that works just fine for me. Cause I don't, I think that there's not a lot of artifice in what I say and do. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun. I recently started a podcast. I guess it's not recently. We're almost at a year, which we keep, like, planning our anniversary or whatever.
That's the hardest thing ever, is what's the anniversary of a podcast that's about a certain thing? Is going to be a special or something?
Yeah. Or like, whatever. But we're kind of intentionally keeping it really chill. Like, we're only now, we're a year in, we're only now being like, should we talk about whether or not we wanted to be, like, do we want to format? Do we want to, like, have a Patreon? Do we want to, like, do the podcast things that people do? And we're still kind of unsure, but just keep recording every 2 weeks. Like, we'll figure this out at some point. We'll make a decision, or we won't.
I know in a lot of situations. Oh, you know what? Hold on.
You're listening to Can't Sell This, a podcast about creativity, creatives, and their process, with your hosts, Hugh Elliott and Stefan Grambard.
This is another episode of Can't Sell This, the podcast about creatives, creativity, and their processes. And with me today is, let me be honest here, is your tag in a lot of things is Max Wellander. And so I took it to mean your name was Max Wellander. Like, I thought your last name was Wellander. And it was only until a little while ago that I went, oh my God, that's Maxwell Ander.
It's so this is a very common mistake with my name. This is also like a running joke every time. So every once in a while I'm on like a RPG stream and I'll have to introduce myself and then I have to like say my Twitter handle and I right. always have to make a joke about it because it's Maxwell Lander, but three L's looked so awkward.
Okay.
And it didn't like, so the correct way to spell it, it just looked horrible when I wrote it down.
Maxwell.
And so
I
just didn't take it. And so many people in life have thought that my name is Maxwell Lander. And like, to be honest, I'm a little tempted. Like I just got through changing my name because I'm really bad at paperwork, but I'm a little tempted to just like switch that over and be like, Wellander. Yeah, sure. I'm
going to go. It sounds very English. I mean, why not?
There can be only one. It's the B grade Highlander or whatever.
But maybe not. So Lander, Maxwell Lander.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. All right. Mm. Well, I feel better because there's also you would know her or them as Lee Jones. Lee Jones does a lot of fabric tactile work. And I used to think because their tag was by Lee Jones and I didn't mm-hmm. realize it was by Lee mm-hmm. Jones. I thought it was by Lee. I thought their name for some reason was by Lee and I didn't question it. Who the fuck am I to question that? So for the longest time. Until I saw they did a byline and their name was Lee Jones. And I was like, oh my God, I'm just the dumbest human.
It's just one of the problems of how we meet people. These like, not that we didn't actually meet on Twitter, but like how we get to know people or whatever as like through internet handles now.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
there's not a lot of consideration. Like I know a lot of people that go by, you know, their actual names or whatever on Twitter, but most people do not. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fine. I'm just sad that I can't get the online handle that I want everywhere. Like it's too late now. You can't get the handles you want unless you like actually right. usually use your name. Or I'd have a fun, I don't know. I'm of an age where handles have a nostalgic fun quality to them.
Right.
And I'd probably just, cause I keep putting Snackswell everywhere when I'm just Snackswell. Like, I would just put Snackswell everywhere. That would just that's be really what funny. It is. But now like, because that's like my Discord name, people actually just refer to me as that. I'm like, great. Hey, yeah, that's fine. Yeah. Whatever. I don't care. Great.
I wasn't able to be Hugh Elliott because there's a writer named Hugh Elliott and he is older than I am and pre-exists all
got
that
there
shit.
First.
But Hugh Q. Elliott is fine. And at least there's nobody going, I thought your name was Quelliot. You know, like that doesn't happen very often. So
for a long time, I like have switched around a bunch, but for a long time, because I was in the middle of like changing my name, right? Because Maxwell Lander is a name that I kind of chose for myself. Kind of. It's a whole story. I wanted to like bridge the gap between what was my legal name and what I wanted to be referred to as. And so I was going by N. Maxwell Lander. Like I kept the N, which is from the old name. Mm-hmm. And so there's and that also looks really awkward when just written, written out with no capitalizations and no spaces or whatever. Also super weird. Mm-hmm. But I think at least that like made people understand that more words were happening. Like they had to like hunt for the words and then kind of fill in the gaps. I don't know.
Yeah, that's like the poorly advised URL therapist's choice.
Yeah.
There's a van that drives around the west end of Toronto and it says therapist's choice. And I'm always like,
did nobody see it? Just did nobody see
could
it?
We have added a dash anywhere in there to just.
Did you not see it? Yeah.
Yeah. So anyways.
Next year it'll be Maxwell Lander and this will come out and I'll be like, no, that's a lie now.
Yeah, I'll get a defamation suit brought against me. Anyways, here's where I'd like to really launch it. Normally I say like, oh, could you introduce yourself? But which I could do. Do you want to introduce yourself at all?
Oh no, let's dive
no,
right
not
in.
At all.
I'm excited about this.
Okay.
This new path you want to go upon.
It's the idea that and we covered it really quickly at the beginning and before I started recording was the idea that you are sort of barraged by your ideas. You're barraged by your creative pursuits. And it's as someone who sort of follows you on Twitter, I think only Twitter, I don't think I follow you on Instagram. Maybe I do. Doesn't matter.
Twitter.
The most the most information I get on your comings and goings is on Twitter. And you talk about a podcast that you're co-hosting, and you were saying it's been a year now, or almost a year.
Yeah. Yeah, we're planning up to a year, and that's wild. That's a wild thing. It's a podcast about like role-playing game books.
Okay. And so what's the podcast called?
The podcast is called Read the Fucking Manual.
RTFM.
Yes.
And RTFM is that a grandfathered in phrase? RTFM? Is that a thing that, FTW and...
No, I don't. I mean, I think a lot of people use it. I think I have had people say RTFM to me, like, as in I asked a question about something that was easily answerable, right, and had someone be like RTFM.
Like that. Let me Google that for you.
So I definitely think it's like a phrase that lives in its own land. Mm-hmm. And I don't even think we're the only RTFM podcast. That's like super, okay. We did a super bad Google check before launching it. Cause we're kind of just hacks like that. So we're like, whatever, we're just going to do it.
Well, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's funny. One of the things that I've talked about in the past is naming things and how much I enjoy naming things and how I can get kind of bummed out if the initial name I've come up with has been used. And I always kind of think, oh, I don't want to do it. And we were really lucky with Can't Sell This. No one is saying it. And even now, 3 years later, no one is saying it. Four years later. Thank you. But, the thing is when we first started talking, we were Stefan and I, we were saying, oh, we're going to call it Can't Sell This Shit. We can't sell this shit. And I remember really early going like, I don't want to swear. I'm fine with swearing on the podcast, but I don't want it to be part of the name. So when you say RTFM, is the podcast, does it actually say that in it? Read the fucking manual, or does it just say RTFM?
It does not. It says RTFM.
Okay.
Which is an intentional. Yeah. Like, I don't think that Spotify would be so pleased with us if we put, especially there are some swear words, they're going to let slide.
I think they flag those things.
The big one, right? Like that's not.
Yeah. I remember talking to a friend of mine saying like, I'll have a hard time not swearing on my podcast. Do I have to label it as not safe for work? And he goes, I don't. And his podcast has been around for a decade at that point. And he's like, no, just say no, just say it's safe for work. Who cares? Someone wants to flag it, knock themselves out, but you can pull whatever you want.
I just don't live in a world where swearing is a thing that people pay any, like, I understand there are worlds where people pay attention to that, but I can't, I say this as a, like, I don't ever notice when people swear. And to the point where in my master's thesis defense, which went very well and was super, it was a fun time and whatever, this was a chunk of years ago. But one of the profs at OCAD afterwards was like, you didn't need to swear that much. And I was like, oh my God, did I swear? Like, it didn't even register to me that it, because I was like, that is a context in which I probably would try not to swear, but also I was really nervous, right? And it's one of the, when I'm nervous, I make jokes and I swear a ton. And so I was for sure just like trying to get through it. And then after the fact, they were like, yeah, the only thing I could say is you really didn't need to swear so much. And I was like, oh no.
Yeah. From the first to second visit with my in-laws, I remember after leaving, my Lib said to me, well, my mom said, wow, he isn't drinking as much and he wasn't swearing nearly as much. And I thought, I'm not sure that's an indictment or a good thing. It's like, what did I do the first time? Was I like kicking kittens and like, like, fuck this place. And what kind of garbage house do you live in? And because they live in a really nice house, But anyway, so that's neither here nor there.
Swears, but yes.
So swears are nothing to me. So you got your master's in some digital media or something like that. What was it called again?
Yeah, the program is called Digital Futures.
Digital Futures. Okay.
Mm-hmm. At OCAD.
Good old and OCAD. How do you feel about that? Got that old master's degree. Like, does it lead to a career of
Yeah, it's just people just show up at my house with truckloads of money now.
Hugh, I do a podcast on
on role-playing games. It's going really well.
Have you not been? I live in Nova Scotia now. I had to leave the province.
Yeah. I mean, what's funny about me, so I don't have an undergrad degree.
Okay.
I convinced OCAD to let me in to graduate school without any other schooling. Because I had been a career photographer for a decade, like over a decade when I applied to go. And so they were willing to see that as somewhat equivalent to. Right.
Well, and the quality of the work too. There are lots of shitty photographers who've been doing their job for 10 years. And you're
thank
like,
you.
I wouldn't call that a degree at all. It's, that's barely a high school diploma.
I grew up, my mom was in university growing up. And so like, I joke about this, but I went to my first women's studies class when I was like 8 years old, cause she couldn't afford childcare always. And so I would frequently go to class with her. And so like, I grew up in a very academic environment. So writing the application, it was easy for me to like convince them that I kind of knew some of the lingo and
got the jargon.
And so the master's degree like did actually change the trajectory of my career because I didn't have any schooling. And so for things, but that was also part of why I went into it. Like for things like I was never going to get a grant. I was never going to get an art grant before that, because if you don't have some kind of university education and like ideally a graduate university education, grants don't care about who you are.
Right.
There's like the granting bodies in Canada are nonsense, except when they give me money. But
they don't listen to this podcast. You've got to worry about slagging on that.
It's definitely like once you've gotten one, you can get more. And if you can get on somebody else's, then you have a better chance of getting your own. And so it's just this weird, this whole weird thing. But you definitely need some kind of university credit on there. And so I went to school like knowing that that's what I wanted out of it. I was like, I just want it on my resume. I want it on my CV. I want to be able to get grants. I'm not expecting anything else from this experience. And so I had a blast. I actually think in like a different way than other people I went to school with, because I think they really were like, I want to get a job. I want to get this design job here, or I'm going to like progress my career or whatever. And I was like, nah, I'm just going to do stuff. And what matters is that it's done at the end and I can say I did it.
That's great.
Because the thing about university is like, once you're done, nobody cares what you did while you were there.
Well, and also, and it's also, it's funny, but like once you're going into your master's, you've already done 4 years of university. For the most part, there's not a lot of gap in between getting your degree and going in for your master's.
Yeah.
Right? Like you went in going, I've been working for 10 years. And there's a bunch of students going, oh, I've been in school for 4 years already. I'm really tired. And it's like, so for you, you're like, oh, this is refreshing and great. And for them, like I did 5 years of school in a row. And like that fifth year, I talked about like doing a sixth year and taking computer animation. And I remember looking at it and they're going, well, you'd be a shoo-in. You don't have to apply, really. I mean, we have a spot. And it was like me talking to the coordinators of the program. And I just went, I can't. It's been 5 years of school. Like, I want to get out of here.
It's definitely one of those things that I think, one, I mean, I think it should be free.
100%. Yeah.
This, because I don't think we should pay for most things. But I don't support money as a concept, but it's fine. I think the value of it, of school. So this is funny because I now teach at university.
Oh, do you? Okay.
So I say this as a person who's like, now I have to teach this to the children's. But like for me, and I think that for creative endeavors, the value of university is not putting a fixed output on it, right? Like the value is not putting a lot of pressure on what comes out of it. The value is exploring and trying stuff and finding out what you love. And like, because they're not teaching you how to run a business, so you're not getting the good stuff anyway. Like you're not getting anything that is super applicable to actually having a career out of art school. And so you might as well just enjoy it for what it is, which is, you know, if you're in a master's degree 2 years, if you're in a bachelor's degree 4 years of fucking around. And if you can fuck around and it's not financially stressful, like I didn't get an undergraduate degree because I couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
And so it was like, yeah, I had to go and figure out how to work and get a job and whatever. But if you can't afford it and it's just chill times, like, yes, was I super jealous of all the kids who had it paid for when I was 19 and couldn't go? Absolutely. But for sure, they should just go in and check. That's why I think it should be free. Everybody should get to go and figure, like explore and try stuff and figure out what it is they like. And more importantly, figure out what they hate. Like,
yeah, I think also there is a certain level of energy that you have in your 20s that you don't. I'm now closing out my 40s, and honestly, I do a lot of stuff after hours, and after hours right now is all the time. And so, like, you know, I'll get up, and instead of when I was setting up for this, I set up and then turned around and started playing with an Arduino because I have bought a new OLED display, and I'm like getting distracted, and all of a sudden my alarm goes off like, oh, you got to start this thing. And I think that, you know, the comment, and I've said this plenty of times, but if you're a new listener to the podcast, because you're a fan of Max's, I say a lot, the phrase that happens, the saying is, if you do what you love, you never work a day in your life. And I say, if you do what you love, you're going to work all the fucking time.
All the time.
And it's,
I hate that phrase so much.
I hate it so much. And it's, and I think because of the fact that people who say it, they're not doing something that they love. They're doing something that pays them a lot of money. Right. Yeah. Like there's no such thing as the person who, fuck, I don't know. I don't want to talk down to anybody about what they do, but there's no way you're doing what you love and getting paid a shit ton of money. That just, you know, I know four or five people that are living that life.
Yeah.
They're working all the time, all the time.
Like, when you scratch off the like gold coating or whatever, it's usually wealth all the way down, right? Most people who are saying that are like, yeah, because you don't need money.
They didn't struggle to begin with.
Yeah. And if you lose your job, you're not going to lose your house, or you're not, you know, like you're not going to lose your kids. Right. Yeah. Like I grew up in an environment where like my mom has a bunch of mental health issues. And so like, it was a constant, like, am I going to physically get taken away from my mother? And I think we think a lot about like, I think a lot of people who haven't been super poor think that the kind of the floor getting pulled out from under you is, oh, I lose my apartment and I have to find another one, or oh, I have to eat rice this week or whatever. And I'm like, those are very real things that I have faced that are not nice. And then there's also, what if you lose your family? Right. Yeah. And they're like, there's all these other terrible things that we don't understand have to do with a lot with money. And a lot with like, because money is also how you access, like, you know, healthcare for the most, even in Canada, right? Yeah. Like those, like time is a thing that you can't afford. And that's a lot where a lot of our health comes from. But like, yeah, it is this weird thing where I'm like, every time somebody says that, I'm like, yeah, you probably don't need the money. That's all I'm hearing is you didn't need the money. It's not a real job.
It's true. I've gone through this discussion so many times, and it is one of those, like, I grew up in a precarious situation financially my entire life, and nothing's changed as far as I can tell, except I do own my house and I barely make the mortgage. So that's what matters here. But, you know, somebody had said to me, oh, you really know how to market yourself. And I bristled at it because I thought, I'm not marketing myself at all. I'm not. And I don't ever think of it like that, because when I see people who do what I think of as marketing themselves, there's a whole lot of finger guns and, you know, and that's not who I am. Like I tend to show videos of not me, but just my hands and like me touching stuff. And like, hey, look at like ASMR for electronics or something, but it isn't about, it's never been about me. Right.
Yeah.
Like the podcast isn't about me. The networking event is never about me. And then I realized that what they're talking about is, I'm really good at talking about the stuff I'm doing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I also think there's probably like a confidence level there. Not that we're always super confident that what we're doing is meaningful, but, you know, like I went into a store today that is run by my neighbor. We hadn't been in, she's a jeweler and it's very cool. And so we wanted to like check out her store, and she didn't know, like, I only know her as a neighbor, and she didn't know that I'd been a photographer forever. And it came up, and she was like, oh, I'm always looking for photography. And, you know, Izzy, my partner, being who she is, was like, also, Max is very good. And I was like, yeah, I'm not being a jerk, but I am really good. And when people hear that, I think they think I'm marketing myself. And I'm like, I'm not. You don't have to hire me. I don't actually care.
Yeah.
but also, I do know that I'm really good at this one thing. There's a lot of things that I feel like I'm really not good at.
Yeah.
But I feel like because I can talk really confidently about the thing that I have in the past and do occasionally still do for money, there is a perception of like, oh, well, yeah, you're marketing. Like, you're trying to make me believe that you're trustworthy. And I'm like, no, I'm actually just really good
at this job. Yeah. It, you know, it is, I think because I live in a a perpetual state of self-doubt that it, anytime someone compliments me, I think of it as like a backhanded thing. Like it's never, there's never a legitimate. So if a photographer says, oh my God, I saw the LMC work you're doing with the rainbow stuff. And it's so beautiful. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm not a photographer. You know what I mean? But I took photos for an entire year and I am really good at this particular thing. Now there's no way I would ever say I could do any other type of photography, but I know this type of photography inside and out. And I still don't feel confident, but I can say I know how to do that. You know, like it's such a weird thing to have to qualify on a sort of consistent basis just for your own edification. You know?
Yeah. It's funny. Cause like everything else that I do, I have a lot of self-doubt about. And for some reason, photography has existed for a long time. Like it wasn't long after I started that I was like, oh, I'm good at this. Oh, I got it. I can do this. But every other, like, cause I have many creative endeavors and everything else that I like put out into the world, I'm like, is it shit? It might be shit. Sorry about it. I don't know if it's shit.
Do you feel that the reason you can feel confident about the photography work is because it's 100% out of you. Like the eye, the composition, the subject matter, everything is, it's directed by you to make it a good piece, right? Like there's not a lot of you. I've seen some of your photos where I'm like, I would never have ever thought to do what you did. And it looks just astounding. There's so many striking photos. I've never seen a bad photo that you've done. If you're willing to share bad photography, I'm willing to look at it.
Yeah. I can send you some stuff. I mean, it's also the joy of digital, right? It's like you take
thousands of photos
and you pick the one. I actually really strongly believe that being a really good photographer right now is just being a good self-editor. And most people lack the critical eye to pick the shot they took that is the best, not to have taken the shot. It's a whole other different thing. Cause I've like talked to a lot of photographers and like gone through people's work and helped people like put together a book or put together a portfolio. And they're like, oh, I like this. And it's like, and there isn't stepping back and being like, what's good about it to other people usually isn't super present. And I don't think that always needs to be there either. This is like, if you want to get into the money side of thing. If you're putting something out for your like creativity, don't do that process. Pick the photos you love. Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have kind of always, and that wasn't a thing that I knew until somebody explained it to me. I was lucky and I grew up with a photo mentor. And at one point he was like, yeah, the thing, like you can take the shot and you have the technical lighting skill and you're interested in like making creative environments and whatever. And I worked in Photoshop before I ever picked up a camera. And so Photoshop has always been a really big part of my workflow. Mm-hmm. But he was like, but the thing that is different, like he's worked with a ton of photographers and he was like, the thing that's different is that, you know, like you can take 100 shots and in 30 seconds, know this is the one out of those 100 and the rest of them are trash. And it's not like find the ones that are kind of okay and put them all against each other. It's this is the one. If I get one, like that is my thing. If I get one photo that I have that internal response of like, yep, that's it. I don't care about the rest of the shoot, which is kind of opposite to how photography functions now, because it's all like, oh, I need to put up a photo every hour on Instagram. So I need this 240 shot photo shoot to contain 60 photos that are usable. And I'm like, yeah, that's why everything's trash.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny. I actually, that was a lesson that I'd learned. Cause I took photography cause I was in an art school too, but you know, I took photography. And one of the things I learned was because I was processing my own film. Right. And it just, you couldn't take a gazillion photos cause you were stuck having to develop a gazillion photos. So now with digital, it's like, I will take 100 pictures for the rainbow stuff, for the pride stuff, and then turn around and decide, you know, some of these are okay. And some of these are just awful because of whatever. But wow, there is one good one in there, but I'll share like 8 or 9 because you can share 10 or whatever it is on Instagram. But there's one in there that I'm like, if anybody mentions the one, I'm like, yeah, I know. Right. Yeah. That's a good one. And the rest are like, I don't know this one.
And like, you know, to just slam everybody on the internet, most people don't know. Like, right? Like most people don't know the difference. Most people put up 6 photos and all of their audience is like, yeah, these are great. Or these are whatever, right? Like, that's not how we engage with the photographic medium, right? We don't engage with the photographic medium for a like, oh my God, wow, what is that?
Well,
and they're like, yeah, I get it. I'm scrolling.
Is consumption, not discerning. So like, we're not there to look at someone's photos and go, well, I don't like any of these. We're there to just affirm that they shared them and were willing to get into their lives through that. And it's the shallowest form of relationship that exists right now. And it's shitty.
This is funny because I feel like a lot of this might be about like, you know, I am young still, but I'm old enough to have like not grown up with the internet, and like the internet wasn't around when I was very small, and I still kind of bristle at like online connection and that kind of, like I'm still very critical of that being like the way in which we kind of communicate with one another, interact with one another, form connections. And I feel like that is also part of, I don't know, that has some relationship to how I feel about like making photography. And part of why I stopped making it as much is definitely because of the way the internet works, because the internet, while everybody's like, yeah, the internet's, you can share images all the time. And I'm like, yeah, exactly. And nobody cares. Not a single person on the internet cares about good photography.
Yeah. A week,
photographers.
A week or two later, and the photos you took that were just mind blowing are just there, you know, and they no longer have the value and weight that they should have. I have a question. And actually it's directly related to the whole fact that we're in a pandemic and, you know, were you interested in RPGs before the pandemic, or has closed down really, really driven your interest?
No, I've been playing RPGs for over 20 years.
Okay.
So it's definitely was a part of my youth. I was a very unhappy teenager, as we all were. I was a very unhappy teenager. But I am and have always been fat and a raging homosexual. And so the teenage years were a little rough for old Max. And I found a queer Dungeons and Dragons group when I was 13 years old, and they were all adults, which was wild. Exclusively adult. Now I think about it and I'm like, it's very great, very important for me. But also I was 13 and everybody was in there. I think the next youngest person was 23. And the person who ran it, I think, was close to 40. So it's a lot. It was wild. It was a wild time. But I went every Friday night because I could avoid the world. I could avoid school. I could avoid everybody I knew at school. Like, it wasn't even like, this isn't following me anywhere. This is just like my little oasis. I don't know, not to be super cliche, but it for sure helped me survive teenagedom to have access to like some queer people and a nerd space. Because I went to Rosedale Heights, which is now a school for the performing arts.
Okay.
But it wasn't a performing arts school when I went, and it sucked. It's the worst. I'm sure it's better now because performing arts. So I'm sure it's not the crazy people.
I was the singular, so much gayer now.
I'm just super gay. I was the singular out queer person at my high school in downtown Toronto.
That seems unlikely.
But, yeah, until but grade also, 11. I mean, they started coming out later, and now everybody that went there is lots of them. I think probably most of them are queer now. But in high school, I was the only out one, and so it was a rough go.
A trendsetter on two fronts, both photography and being gay. Good for you.
Yeah, always been extremely gay. I mean, my parents are queer, right? So it's like it was the default. It's not like I'm queer spawn, and so it's like it's just always been a conversation in the house. So I do queer think spawn. That I figured it out much earlier than a lot of other people.
That's a D&D module, Queer Spawn, I think.
It should be.
Well, it is now.
Yeah, my next release, Queer Spawn. But yeah, RPGs have always been around. The shift in the pandemic for me was like, oh, what am I going to do with my time? Mm-hmm. And I'm starting to see, like, I was just kind of starting to see the edges of like indie RPG space. And I was like, wait, people just make games they think are cool and put them on the internet, and it's low stakes and you can just do it. And now I have all this time at home to do it. And I have been, you know, I've been a photographer and I've been a graphic designer. And so I was like, I can make a cool physical product. Like I've been doing that for other people. I can probably, if I can just figure out some writing or figure out a mechanic or whatever, like,
okay, see, there you go. This is what I want to get into is, you know, just, I know a lot of people who can do visual work, but aren't great narrative people, but then there also know a lot of narrative people who really aren't very good visual people. So did you sort of tackle it in a way where you went, I'm going to partner up with someone who's a narrative person, or did you decide to start making that part of your lexicon, like photographer, designer, and story builder, world builder.
I did definitely just jump off. I was like, yeah, no, this is fine. I can do this. I have since actually partnered a number of times with people who are better writers than I am, at the very least as editors for the biggest project is Himbos of Myth and Metal, right? Which just came out, and it, for that one, because it's like a hardcover, whatever RPG book, I was like, I need somebody to edit this. And part of that is that self-doubt of, is this shit, right? Like part of it is like, I can pay an editor, one, to make sure it's not shit, but also to occasionally, like the nice thing about having an editor is they will occasionally tell you when it's not shit, right? They will also be like, this is really great, do more of this here or whatever. And it is like, you're getting an extra added bonus of somebody teaching you how to get better at the thing you're doing.
It's funny. We've actually interviewed a number of authors, and every time when we talk about the editing process, their gratitude towards their editor is so on their sleeve. You know, I have yet to speak to an author who says, fuck the editor, man. Like the editor is honestly, it's their greatest advocate, because they're the person whose, their only goal is to make the writing better.
Yeah. Yeah. That's rad. And
was that your experience? Like, it was just like, oh my God, thank you for you.
Yeah, I mean, I hired a friend who is a great writer and also a game designer, Aaron King, who is my co-host on the podcast. We've decided to like just entwine our RPG lives quite a bit, and they've been really great for helping me like just be able just it, simple things, because I actually find writing really hard. I find it hard. I don't think I'm horrible at it, but everything that I have put into the world has been so laborious in comparison to like, so for example, I have a backburner project with Natalie Zena Walshots, who has been on this podcast.
Yeah, the author of Hench.
Yeah. And we've worked on stuff in the past, and we have an RPG that we have kind of been like noodling on for a couple years actually. And it may just be a heartbreaker that we never finished, but we just work on it together. And Natalie has this, I mean, obviously, like the thing Natalie relates to writing similar to how I relate to photography, right? It's like, oh, I am so good. Like, I know I got it. I do this all the time. Mm-hmm. Not that I think she's naturally as cocky as I am, but I have been in the room when she has written stuff, and she goes into like a mini fugue state and then will spit out just the best words instantly. And I'm always like, I don't understand how that happens. I've watched people do that. I do not understand how people can do that. That is the exact opposite of me, where I will stare at an empty screen for like 8 hours and then I'll write a sentence.
I have the synopsis of so many stories written out where I can't go any further. I just write the synopsis and go, yeah, that's a really awesome idea. I really wish I was an author, because I could write the shit out of this, you know, but I'm not a writer as much, you know.
You can write RPGs. The nice thing about RPGs is that they're really forgiving writing medium, because it's not like it doesn't need to contain good prose. It's great when they do, right? But they don't need to, because like, for example, the thing that the masters did to my trajectory is I learned how to make video games, and now I teach video games and I do Unity development. And so like game design wise, I find the game design stuff really compelling and quite easy and super fun. And then it's the writing, the flavor on top of that, that I find difficult. Right.
Right.
And sometimes I just need to remind myself that I can be like, you can just write the rules. You can just write the rules and you can go back afterwards and make them fun, but you can just like write them simply and you've done your job making an RPG.
I think what people forget when they hear the acronym RPG is the R is role, right? Yeah. Like it's, you're playing a role-playing game. So like you're handing someone like, hey, by the way, you are whoever you want to be within the bounds of the game.
Yeah.
You're going to decide what the vocabulary is when it comes to how you're going to talk to somebody. You're going to decide who your character is within the bounds of the game. So it's amazing to think like I don't think I would want to write a role-playing game because because I think I would want to control the way the person talks. And I don't think that that's appropriate, obviously, in a role-playing game. But
I mean, you can write a D&D supplement. That's kind of how they work. I slam D&D a lot, which is funny because I've spent a large chunk of my life playing it. But that's kind of where they are. But yeah, like the more open games that are somewhat like that. And so you can kind of just get the words out that are crucial and mm-hmm. leave the rest. And some games obviously have a bunch of like beautiful writing in it. It's just like the way that I remind myself kind of like, you don't have to do that. Mm-hmm. You can just trust the player to like add all that and get out of the way a bit. Yeah. But it's writing is so hard. It's so hard.
If it's any consolation, the editing process for me means that when there's super long dead space where I'm just letting you talk and there's zero weight to those dead spaces. I don't mind you.
Oh yeah.
To ramble. I have a Patreon and one of the things that I really wanted to do was teach people how to podcast. And I wanted it to be the simplest version of podcasting there could possibly be and the cheapest version of podcasting mm-hmm. it could possibly be. And I spoke with Melissa Martinez, who I worked with at the WWE, and she has a podcast where they started it when the pandemic began and they were all unemployed. And she used her iPhone, just put it on a table, and the three of them sat around this iPhone and just recorded. And then she did her editing on Audacity, which is free. And then she used Libsyn, which is some aggregator to podcasting. Yeah. And you pay a minimum monthly fee or something like that. And I was just like, tell me more about, and she's like, are you being facetious right now? Like she, because everything that we do, the things that we do that we now see as second nature are someone's first time, yeah. right? Someone's first experience of, anytime someone asks me about podcasting, I always just kind of go, it's not that hard. And it can't be that hard because I'm doing it. And yeah. if it was hard, I probably would have given up, right? Like there are things about this that are absolutely fucking laborious. Editing is a laborious process. Every other aspect of this is just recording and then putting it out there. And anytime someone says like, what kind of listenership do you have? Like, what can you got any numbers? Cause when I went looking for, I was like, can you be sponsors for Dismissed, the other podcast? And somebody said like, how many listeners do you have? I said, I don't know. And that's when I realized, oh my God, this matters to people. Numbers matter to people because to them, that's the value of success. Like that's how you evaluate success, right? Not the value of success, evaluate it. But in my mind, those numbers are a distraction.
Yeah.
Right. What I care about is that individual that messages me directly and says, I listened to that episode and thank you because that really resonated with me because I just recently lost my job. That's all I care about right now. Like if I cared about numbers, oh my God, what a pain in the ass my life would be.
Yeah. I mean, also like podcast numbers are bad. It turns out
super bad.
Turns out I don't care about like, well, I'm not our podcast is not super concerned with numbers either. Like we have a Discord and every time that somebody posts in the Discord, like I just listened to the episode. It's great. I have thoughts about it. I'm like, this is amazing. I would love to extend the conversation we had in this. This is wonderful. This is exactly what I wanted from it.
Yeah.
Cause I know that when we started, it was that there were at one point it was like, oh, this episode got something like 200 listens or whatever. And then there was some pop-up that was like, you're doing better than 90% of podcast. And I was like, oh my God. Oh no. Yeah,
it's nuts.
That's not okay. This is different than I thought.
And that's not, I mean, I don't know. Like it's such a strange thing because what happened to the podcasts that existed, like mine that existed before the pandemic, was it all shut down. All podcasting became a nothing burger because of the fact that nobody was listening to podcasts. Nobody was commuting anymore. So nobody was listening to podcasts. So that was a frustration for the first year. And then what happened was a whole lot of celebrities who had nothing better to do started podcasts. So they instantly got all the listens. They got all of the time and they got all of the funding. They could self-fund till the cows come home, but then they all started getting advertising because advertisers weren't being able to advertise on live events because that wasn't happening.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I came to the conclusion that it didn't matter. Doesn't matter, you know, and yeah. It was so much easier once I did that, because I was going down a very dark hole where mm-hmm. I was getting pissed off with other people. I'm like, how are other people affecting me this much? Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then I stopped giving a shit. With the other RTFM, have you listened to the other RTFM podcasts? Have you checked them out?
No, I haven't. I should. But
do you think
not.
That they're all about RPGs, or do you not?
Oh,
think...
I know none of them are about RPGs.
Oh, okay.
I think they're exclusively other things.
Oh, okay.
So I haven't listened to them. And ours is, it's very apparent, like when you search RTFM in Spotify or whatever, it's like, here's the super nerdy icon. Follow the nerds. You will find us.
The Pied Piper of podcasting. Yeah. Come along.
It's weird because I feel like we should like put up front potentially our politics a little bit more, because there's a couple other podcasts that are not dissimilar to us that are also great. But there are like RPG podcasting is not new, right? But I think because we have a podcast where we're like, we just read RPG books and then we talk about it. We call it the role-playing game book club podcast. So we kind of treat them like books and read them from cover to cover and then chat about them.
Okay.
And for the first little bit, it was mainly old books. Like we were like, oh, we want to go back and like see what everybody talks about. Turns out they're all super racist and messed up. And unsurprisingly, yeah. I think about like ancient,
I don't think there's
geek
any
culture,
surprise in that.
Right? That's, and so our podcast ends up being, I think we get people that come to listen to the episode about a game that they loved when they were younger, and then it's the two of us being like, this is dumb. this is horrific. This is super offensive. This is like poorly designed. Like Aaron is kinder than I am, which is important. It's important to have somebody who balances your energy, I guess. But we just kind of go off on stuff, but we are both pretty, you know, politically active and aware, and so tend to be like, oh, I hate all this crap in here. This is mm-hmm. super offensive and we should just not put this in our games. And I don't think that's what people expect the podcast right. to be, because they just think it's another like role-playing game podcast or whatever.
Well, yeah, I have been it's been very hard for me to hide any of my politics when I when I talk, because I'm super anti-capitalist, and I am very pro-gay, pro-queer, anti-racist. I am about as left as you can possibly get without being a full-on communist. And I just...
it'll be all of us in our old age. I just need to be more informed
just,
to commit to communism.
Like, it's funny because like usually they say, well, the older you get, the more conservative you get. And I'm just finding I'm like bristling at the whole thing and getting angrier and angrier at what's going on, because it's so obviously against people in general. Like everything is going against people, and you're like, wow, how are we all kind of following down this particular path, when if we just showed a little common sense and some mutually applied decency, none of this shit would happen. But
yeah,
we can't do it because we weigh our value against the color of our skin and whether or not we like the same gender, and I don't know, it's so dumb.
It is in fact very dumb. Not being helped by the internet, I don't think.
Not being helped by the internet, which is apparently just a tinder box of of people throwing lit matches at gas cans and going, I hope this doesn't blow up, and then it does, and they're surprised. What? Why did that happen? So when it comes to the million ideas and inability to decide the value of each one, and whether or not you're gonna focus. Do you just keep a spreadsheet somewhere where you say, this is a new idea and I'm going to write it down? Or do you instantly dive into that thing?
I wish I was organized. I am a beast of chaos. I sometimes, when I have an idea that I think I'm really going to like, I will open up Google Keep and make a note about it. Mm-hmm. And then I'll open up Google Keep like 3 weeks later and realize that I have made a bunch of singular disorganized notes and will probably not go back to most of them. I tried for a while, like I've tried a variety of different techniques to kind of organize my brain. Mm-hmm. But it tends to be the thing, either I will do it very quickly, mm-hmm. Or if the idea sticks around, like if it just naturally sticks in my brain, mm-hmm. then I will carry it on later.
Yeah.
If it's like, oh, I thought about this for a couple of days, I'm actually going to sit down and work on it. But it's usually like only if it survives the gauntlet of my other thoughts to show up a couple days later.
I think that's why writing for me is easier to ignore, because I don't instantly want to write. I don't instantly, like, I have nothing. Like, you're seeing me, but my desk is a mess. Well, I can just show you. Hold on. My desk is a mess of wires and devices you know, shit just piles up, and I go, you know, there was a thing I wanted to do with that, and I never bothered to finish it. But I learned, and what I've started to do, and this may come to you at some point too, is, and you may just go, that's fucking stupid. But what I've started to do is, I have an idea for a project, right? I say, I want to do this. I want to make this. I wanted to make motorized wings for my kid, for a cosplay that they wanted to do. But really what I wanted to do is figure out the mechanical aspect of it. I wanted to figure out how to make wings open and close and activate a linear actuator with a relay, and how could I do it in the simplest way possible, because it's going to be operated by a 10-year-old or 11-year-old now. But, you know, their interest waned and they no longer want to do it. But I did figure out how to make the wings, and I did make the wings to the extent that I was happy with. And so what I've started to do is set there's a secondary goal. The primary goal is to do the project from start to finish, but the secondary goal is the learning I wanted to get out of it. And it's made me way more, let me think of the right word for it. Way more accepting of my scattered head. And like, I no longer hold it against myself when I don't get something completed, right?
Yeah, I'm a little like that. I tend to be like really, I don't know, maybe the only reason I ever actually like could be a photographer is that I tend to finish the things I start, but I don't start a lot of projects.
Okay.
I don't even start a lot of projects. That isn't to say I finish them all. Like, there's definitely stuff that sits unfinished, especially in RPG space. I find finishing stuff really hard. Because, like, I don't know if it's the nature of RPGs, but I've talked to a lot of other like game designers that have us, like, we all have 700 ideas that we want to complete, and very few of them make it through that one. Very few of them make it past a Google note where it's like, make this weird little thing. And but when I start like a visual arts project, I usually finish them. I think my like direct, I'm trying to figure out like what I think my direct relationship, like, is there any consistency between the ones that actually get finished?
Right.
And I feel like more often than not, it's actually like, do I have a lot of the skills already available to me to finish it? Like, how much do I have to learn? Because like photo projects are easy peasy. And so if I have a photo idea, it's not really that difficult to go out and finish it. It's usually like, do I have the resources? Do I have the space? Do I have people? Whatever. Not do I have the skill? But if I don't have the skill for something, then I want to learn it. And obviously, I don't think you can be a person who pursues 700 million creative endeavors without being a good like self-learner. And I like to continue to learn things all the time. But often the learning part will take the project away. Like, I'll end up getting caught up in the learning, and I'll like learn something else. And then I'll be like, oh, now that I know more, I actually don't want to make that project anymore. I want to like do something else. Whereas if it's an idea that sits exactly within my wheelhouse, I'm like, no, I can just complete that. I can just do that. I'll do that tomorrow or whatever.
For sure. For sure. And I think in a lot of cases, I react like that as well. I say, well, I can't do this until I've learned that. And I can't learn that until I've learned that. And I can't, you know, I can tend to shut myself down. And we go about this with home renovations as well. Anytime there's a home reno, if Lib says to me, can you deal with this? I give her the list of things that have to happen before that one thing can be accomplished. And it's the most innocuous thing that needs to be done, but I have 15 things that need to get done before I can tackle it. That's how my brain works. So if I want to if I want to do cosplay wings, well, there's a bunch of stuff I need to learn in advance of that. Like, how do you really straighten wire, right? Like, how do you really straighten wire? Well, I know I've been following a guy on Instagram who makes marble runs. He makes marble machines. He's showed how to straighten wire. Well, I'm going to take 3 hours and go past and go through his Instagram feed to find that one post he did where he showed how to straighten, you know. It's just, everything takes so long when you don't know how to do it. And it
really does.
You need to apply what you don't know to something you want to do. That particular rabbit hole is a deep and circuitous one.
But also, like, I would be lying if I didn't say part of my interest in moving to Nova Scotia was so that more of my life could be that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, ideally, my entire life is that. Because not being concerned about the output, I would finish stuff because I like to finish stuff and I like to put it out there and I really enjoy the dopamine hit of feedback and whatever. But spending more time not having to finish stuff and just being like, oh, I wonder how you straighten wire. I'm going to spend today straightening wire. And there's no backlash. There's no downfall of spending today, like learning how to straighten wire. And I think that is part. So I'm teaching myself electronic music currently, which I have never done. And I feel far too old to be learning a whole new skill like that. It's so massive. But that's the thing where I'm like, I can't output stuff until I feel like there's so much I have to learn before I feel comfortable outputting stuff.
Yeah.
And so much of it is just noodle about. Like, even people who do it professionally, they're like, I'm just going to spend today figuring out how to make the right blorp sound. Right. Like, that's not, it's going to take that long. And I think that's probably why it's not a great career. but as a creative just headspace, it's like, well, it kind of offers infinite exploration space and therefore it's kind of perfect.
Yeah.
But if you want it to be about like the product, then it becomes very difficult. At least
I find now is I need to decide whether or not the finished product needs to look finished. Like, because a lot of the things I make, here we go. So like, The party glove is a good example of this, right? Mm-hmm, I have this idea for a transducer that can play through any surface. It works great. Bluetooth module. I can hook it to my phone and I can play music. And I tested it out in a live setting and it works fine. But how finished did it need to be for me to accept that it was completed, right? Like, the other person that really wanted this is the sound engineer, recording engineer. He's like, I want one of those. And I'm like, okay. And I built a second one because I'm like, I've got a 3D printer and I've got all the shit I need to do it. And it's his birthday tomorrow. So I'm like, here you go. He's like, I'll pay for it. I'm like, oh, I don't feel right about that, you know? But I can open source this. And if you want to buy a transducer and a Bluetooth module off of me versus buy it from someone else, and you can 3D print your own stuff and have a couple of bolts, you could make your own party glove, you know?
Yeah.
How finished does it need to be for it to be finished? So like, I've started to make that my acceptance, is like, I will accept that this could be done right now if I want to not then add audio reactive LEDs to it. If I've got to add audio reactive LEDs to it, I got to learn about op amps and I got to learn FFT and stuff like that.
I have an illness where I need things to look amazing. I like a polish. It's not even that I value polish, because I love other people's projects that are not polished. But for my own work, I'm like, no, this needs to look, even if it's something that I'm doing for the first time ever, I need this to look like an experienced professional made it and put it out as a professional. It is not a brain worm that I would recommend to anybody, because it definitely ends some projects, right? Like it definitely stops me from sharing things. And especially if I've started to share process documentation at any point, then I'm like, no, this has to come out as like something put together at the end of it, which is, it's silly. It doesn't, right? Like, it doesn't, it can just be, but like the stuff that I make, because I've fiddled with electronic stuff, and I think electronics is like a pretty forgiving space for that, because there are whole communities of people who do just want you to open source it, right? Like, that is the value. Like, that's what we want from you. We don't want to buy one that's like woven and knit into some piece of fashion or whatever, right? Like, that's not the, and I think that that's like one of the great places about like maker culture. Not that I think there's a lot of good things about maker culture, but that is a good one.
Well, when I was doing the light bar, well, the first thing I did was I designed a PCB that anybody could make for themselves. When the WWE contacted me about doing the photo shoot for their campaign, I was like, this is open source. You can just buy the shit you want. You can get a 3D printer if you don't have one, which is weird. And you can buy a meter long piece of flooring edging for floor and then throw a, you know, NeoPixel strip into it. No, we would rather you come and do. I'm like, all right, well, it's going to cost you a lot more than just, you know, this is the PCB here. It's really inexpensive, but okay. You know, and I showed up and they're, because they're part of a really capitalist society. Americans are very capitalist. I mean, so are Canadians really, but at the end of it, they were like, so are you going to make this into a product? Are you going to make it into a thing you can sell? And I was like, no. If you go to github.com/HughQElliott and look for LED controller, you can have one too. And I'm like, I don't want to be responsible for your light painting. You know,
you do not want to get into the photography product market. That is That is a particular hellscape in the world. Like, but that's the thing, right? Like, when I was younger, a lot of the photographs that I have made and released into the world are with DIY equipment and lighting and stuff. Like, that was because I was poor. It was like, I can't spend $3,000 on a singular light or whatever. Especially, you know, 20 years ago, it's like, if you wanted something portable, it cost money. If you wanted something that made colors, it cost money, right? Like, it was just like everything was more and more expensive. And and so I was like, well, what can we do with these hardware lights? Like, what can we do with $10 lights? How can I start to build sets, or what do I need to bash together in order to make it work? Because you're not going to see the output. And like, that was fun. It was a fun time on the internet when people were DIYing photo gear. And I'm sure that those places of the internet still exist, but there was definitely a moment in time where that was what photography was, when we were kind of doing this. We're going to disseminate all our knowledge. We're going to share all our experiences. We're going to make weird YouTube videos about our DIY stuff. If it has a weird outcome, that's even better than if it has like the such and such photographer outcome, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the thing that I kind of enjoy about electronics a little bit, is like, there's a little bit of that still. Is like, oh, did it do? It seems like that's a little bit true of music as well. For my limited exposure to like electronic music stuff, is like, people are pretty into, oh, did it do a weird thing? Did you make that yourself? Did you program that piece of software? Did you make whatever, your little home synth or whatnot?
When I took the party glove out, you know, this one is not the one I took out, because the other one I took out just has the speaker, but goes on my hand, right? And when I took it out, this woman was like, oh my god, what is that? And my friend explained it to her, because I was busy hooking stuff up, but I put it on the table, and she's like, you're like a DJ Iron Man. And I'm like, yes, that's like a DJ Iron Man. With, I don't remember what I was playing, but I remember it being not Iron Man-ish, but it was like, all I could think was like, that is how we need to approach a lot of our stuff, is like, just the wonder, like trying to get the wonder back into what we do. Because You can become very caught up in what the end product is going to be, so much so that you won't get it done. That's totally how I'm starting to really treat what I do, as like, man, fuck it. Why do I got to make a whole thing out of this? Like, why can't it just be something that works and does what I had intended it to do?
I also think that that was for a brief moment, that was the dream that sites like Patreon were going to sell us.
Yeah.
And I think that people, because capitalism sucks, people have really poisoned the water of that. Because for me, if I'm supporting you on Patreon, what I want is for you to make the weird, cool shit that you could not make otherwise, which is not the final products. The final products you can make otherwise. That's just a career, right? Like, that is product design, even whatever. Even if you're an illustrator, that is an illustration career, right? And for me, it's like, the point of sites like that is like, how about you chillax for a bit and be able to carve out some time, AKA with this money I'm giving you, to make something that doesn't necessarily have to have capitalistic value. And for a while that was rad. For a while, that's what people were doing. It was like, here, you make this weird art that could have just been art, right? It's not even about how polished it gets, but like, that's the thing that I would like to have exist more in the world, is like, how do we just support each other? Like, not just emotionally, how do I support you making the unfinished thing or whatever, quote unquote, finished enough, open source, whatever. Not just emotionally, not just by saying like, yeah, make that thing and release it. How do I actually like make a little bit of a weird culture about like supporting people making those things.
Yeah. My issue with Patreon, one is I haven't been on it for very long and I don't have very many sponsors, supporters, patrons, whatever. So it's not money I can use towards anything. Totally. Really. You know, it's like $20 a month. So it's, or whatever it is. For people whose job it is to have a Patreon, you see it like, I mean, Libs has a pretty extensive Patreon and she works her day to day around that because it does pay bills and it does help support her work. So, there are things that she does that are very open and very much about, hey, let's make art together. That's quilts. But also there's, you're going to find out about this first because you're my patron versus Instagram, which is clamping down on everything so that no one is being seen anymore. You know, no matter how many followers you have, you're just not getting that kind of response.
Yeah. I mean, I've gone on whole rants about platforms before. And like, I use Patreon as an example, but Patreon has a lot of problems and I don't have a Patreon for a reason. And I think about going back on that reason all the time, but Patreon is also pretty sex negative and like nudity negative. And a lot of the stuff that I've done in the world has involved either sexuality or nudity or whatever. Mm-hmm. And as most queer artists have engaged our queerness in our artwork, and usually anything that has those kinds of rules is pretty queerphobic. And so I try not to, a lot of my stuff just wouldn't have flown there. Like the stuff that I was doing back in the day when I would have wanted to run that, if I was ever going to do it for photography, it would be like the thing that people like about my photography is usually the ways in which it is edgy, and that will get me booted off a lot of platforms.
Right.
Somehow hasn't gotten me booted off like Instagram or Twitter or whatever yet. Somehow has not gotten me. I have many friends who have been booted off of Instagram, but and that's like a whole different other consideration that like is also terrible. I understand. To be fair, I understand why everybody does the choices they make with how they integrate their art into the internet, right? I think it is quite tragic that we, because these platforms have become the way in which we release our art into the world, they have also become dictators of what the art looks like, right?
Yeah.
Like that's, which is...
Listen, when I started doing my thing, it was 1993, maybe 1994, something like that. When I entered the workforce, I think it was 1998, and everything I did that was art based, because I could never get fully integrated into the marketing world, but everything I did that was art based was entirely self-funded. Yeah. But I did a day job that allowed me to self-fund. So once the day job is gone, which happened to me this year, I realized that self-funding had to involve using stuff I already owned and minimally spending to acquire new things. And so I learned and became very much about recycling things I owned and coming up with ideas that involved the things I already owned, because I couldn't take food out of my kids' mouths or not pay the mortgage because I decided to spend $1,000 on some bullshit, you know? And I think we have a hard time with that. I think a lot of people do, and they don't take into account the effort and the thought process behind it to accommodate the life that is also happening, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, like the day job is not just lost to folks like you, but it's just like not an option in the way that it was in the 90s, even the 2000s, right? Like even when I finished and entered the workforce, people got day jobs and those jobs lasted them for decades. And they did, you know, they actually covered their rent, you know, as opposed to like in Toronto, most day jobs ain't covering your rent anymore, you know, same here in Halifax. And I think it's really hard to like, if a day job isn't actually 9 to 5, and if it isn't if it isn't actually limited time-wise, and it isn't actually covering your bills, then it's always going to impede your ability to have a creative output outside it. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, and if it's not an option from the get-go, then I get why people are like, I'm going to monetize my hobby. I'm going to monetize my artistic endeavors or whatever. Yeah. I just think it's I have come to the place where I'm like, oh, I don't, it took me a really long time of monetizing photography to be like, I don't love the way this works as a job. And the job changed as I was doing it. And that was part of why I didn't love it as a job, right? Like, yeah. You know, I started photography when you could still get a full-time job at a magazine as a photographer. Right. And so you could have a day job where you had consistent income, which is, yeah, then I might love my job because it does actually afford me the comforts of a job while also being a thing that I enjoy doing every day, right? But I saw all of those leave, you know, like I started just before stock became standard, and stock took away a lot of photographers' jobs, right? Not not dissimilar to what AI art is going to do for a lot of other people, photographers included. AI art is also going to steal photographers' jobs. It's not like it's just illustrators or whatever. I've seen a lot of stuff that will fool most people. But that's, you know, those things come in waves, and people get chopped out of them. And I think that that's like, you know, for me, it was like, well, if I can't have any consistency, if I am constantly hustling, if I am working all the time, if I am working at 11 p.m. on a Friday on my birthday or whatever, then this is a shitty job, in fact.
Yep.
And it being, and like the ramifications of the thing that I love doing in the world is a shitty job. Like those things being mentally combined sucks. That sucks. That's a sucky moment, at least in my life. I assume other people who have the same experience is also a sucky moment. But
I think the thing is that when you have cultivated your life to surround creativity, to involve creativity on a regular basis, not relatively regular, but 100% regular basis, everything is about creativity. There is an amount of willingness to forego comforts to that don't, like when you talk to people who are in marketing, it's so, I know so many account people in marketing or project managers or whatever in marketing that hate their fucking jobs, hate them, but they will never, ever give them up because it allows them to drink expensive wine and go on expensive trips and have expensive lives. But that there is no satisfaction in their day to day, right? Yeah. When someone gives them kudos about being a good account manager, they just go, you know, like they don't think of it as an accomplishment. There is no accomplishment when you are leading an uncreative life.
Yeah. And I think that's also fine. Like if that's not emotionally detrimental for you to go through, if it is, if the balance works for you.
Yeah.
Then like I, you know, I know some people, my partner included, who are a little better at weaving that balance of like not needing their every day to be all of their creative output and trying to figure out ways to weave it in a little bit and certainly how to make space for it outside of their day job. Mm-hmm. But not like shackling it to their financial worth or their stability or their housing, right? Like when the thing that you love doing is the reason that you can't keep an apartment, it's hard to keep loving that thing.
Yeah.
Right. Like how do you love that thing if it's keeping you unhoused or whatever, right? Yep. Like that will deteriorate the relationship to whatever it is that you're doing. And so I do think it's like emotionally pretty healthy to be like, I'm going to separate those two ideas a little bit. I'm going to give them a different space.
100%.
I'm not terrible at it.
Listen, I'm not saying, I know it sounded like I was talking down about people that choose that. The fact is that that's how most people live. Most people live doing their job. And that's why when we call back to the beginning where we said, if you do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life, is because the people that don't love what they do are working the same amount that you are.
Yeah.
They may make a bit more money, but they're not satisfied with the job that they're doing. And they find their satisfaction in other realms, whether that's working out or fucking taking a pottery class or something. I don't know, but I don't have a problem with it, but I do have a problem with the idea that someone's saying, well, you're good at marketing yourself. Look at what you do. I'm really envious of that. I'm like, I'm envious of you getting paid every 2 weeks and being able to go to the dentist.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like I'm getting by, like we're getting by as a unit, the four of us, but they're by no means are we comfortable anymore. And I'm glad that you appreciate what I'm doing. Why don't you go to Patreon and give me some money on a monthly basis to show me how much you appreciate what I'm doing? You know, like it's, I'm not trying to monetize my life, but I'm trying to afford living.
Yeah.
It's difficult for me to continue to do this and hope for the best while not having a regular paycheck. It's so easy when you have a regular paycheck.
I mean, and it's like, to be fair, I mean, two things. One, I have only had a regular paycheck for 2 years in my entire life. And I was, it was a weird time. But like, this is a current crisis that I am having, right? Mm-hmm. Like I had lived in Toronto for 20 years. I've left Toronto. I'm in a new city, which means I don't have a career here, mm-hmm. because the other reality about being a person who freelances is that it's all your network. And I just decided to leave my network behind. I'm also doing fine because I have a partner that does very well. We're fine. I am not experiencing any discomfort other than the emotional crisis of what the hell am I doing with my life?
Right.
And because I'm a person who is comfortable and has like switched gears, like I don't know if this is a personality trait. I don't know if I've taught myself this. I have no idea where this comes from, but I'm really good at being like, this is not enjoyable. I'm leaving.
Right.
And that could be a job, that could be quitting. Like I don't have, it's funny because if I will absolutely finish a project. And when I'm freelancing, I have a pretty solid work ethic. But as far as when I'm hired by somebody else, people have been like, yeah, I have a really strong work ethic because I've quit jobs. And I'm like, they're paying me to do a thing. And if it's wretched and the agreement is terrible on my end, I'm going to quit. This isn't about work ethic.
That's not what that's about.
This is, I'm getting out because the contract that we have entered into is no longer serving me.
The value of the other podcast, which is about getting fired, is you know, the idea and concept of trading time for money. And if you don't like the time that you're spending, then it's not worth the money you're getting.
Yeah.
So it's not a work ethic thing. If you don't agree with what you're spending your time doing, get out of it. If you can afford to get out of it and you're comfortable with getting out of it, get out of it and get out of it as quickly as you possibly can.
Yeah.
It's not worth your mental health. I quit a job within 5 weeks. And I remember someone saying like, you're a legend because you're the person who quit in 5 weeks. And I was like, but I knew that was a shit job and you knew it was a shit job, but you couldn't leave.
Yeah.
And that's fine. And I accepted that in the moment and I accept it still. And
yeah,
I mean, we need to be ready for that. You know,
it's weird for me. Because I was so poor for most of my life. Mm-hmm. And I'm certainly not anymore. But I, even when I was really poor, I would always walk away if mm-hmm. it was not good. And it's a weird thing. Cause I think that like a lot of people are like, well, you couldn't have been that poor if you chose not to like to quit a job or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was like, the thing that I learned being poor, and I've had a lot of conversations with folks who are poor about this. And there's like two ways that you go. One is like YOLO and one is to become really controlled, right? Like, I think when you experience extreme poverty, it's the same as like, you know, some people who experience some people who experience extreme poverty grow up and are like, I'm going to spend the money I have.
Yeah.
And other people are like, I'm going to save every penny that I have because I didn't have it or whatever. Right. And the logic is because I didn't have it. It's just these like two manifestations. And for me being poor, it was like, I know how to be poor. Yeah. I know if I need to be poor again, I can be poor again. I also know what's not worth it to me to get out of poverty. Right. Like, I also know that like, because I know how to be poor, I know where it hurts emotionally. I know where it's hard for me. I know what it's worth to do that. And I think that for a lot of people who haven't experienced poverty and do jobs or creative outfits or whatever, their fear of what it is very different. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't ever want to have 100%. To experience that. So I'm not going to quit this job. And I'm like, well, I have experience. I'll be fine. I've figured it out every day for the entirety of my life. I will figure it out. This I can't fix. That's my thing with jobs. It's like, this I can't fix. I can't fix that I hate every day. Mm-hmm. I can figure out some other hustle to find rent. You know, like those are, I can figure out a way to get fed. Those are things I can figure out, but I cannot fix this job emotionally being wretched.
Yeah. I don't know if we're coming to the end of this conversation, but I have to point out the fact that I have noticed over your shoulder on the table is a sword.
Oh yeah.
Cause I've been thinking about this camera that's hanging over your shoulder. I'm like, oh, there's a camera. Of course there's a camera. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. And look at that, a sword.
Yeah.
Has taken it too far? That's no longer a game, my friend.
It's a dagger.
Okay. Perspective is important. From a distance, it looked like a sword. It's a dagger. It's just natural and normal.
There are swords in this house. So it's not, I'm not pointing it out. I'm not pointing it out as it's a dagger because I don't have swords. Just it's a dagger. Yeah, that like nerd thread has followed me everywhere. And so when I was a teenager, my parents traveled quite a bit. And one of the things that they started doing when they travel was bring me back some kind of weapon.
Oh my God.
Which might sound really weird. Often it was like there's a really great like medieval nerd Renaissance shop in Montreal, for example. I forget the name of it, but it's really wonderful. And they have like a huge like medieval weapon collection. Hmm. And my parents would go to Montreal quite a bit. And every time they'd come back, that dagger is actually one that I've been trekking around for 20 years that my parents grabbed in that store in Montreal. Sorry. That they just like showed up and were like, sorry, we were gone for a week and a half. Here's a
dagger.
Here's a hammer or whatever.
Right. Was part of that an acceptance of the fact that you were doing a lot of D&D? Was that just like, so.
Yeah, I think they, with my mom is not interested in like science fiction or fantasy, even a little bit, even a little bit. And so I think for her, it's always been like, how do I like support you? Like, how do I show you support without actually having to engage in the thing that you do? Cause it's nerdy and I don't like it. Like I don't, you know, like I want you to do it, but I don't want to do it with you. Yeah. I think was her jam. And like, I mean, you know, she also did that with books. Like we were stupid poor, but she was like, as long as you keep reading books, I will find money for books was the rule when I was growing up. And that was always fantasy books. She was like, these books you read, what the fuck are these books? But as long as you keep reading, I know the math. It's just important that you read. I don't really care what they are, but what are these nerd things that you're reading? But yeah, there's been a number of jokes. At some point, again, I moved literally a week and a half ago. And so all of the weapons are packed up, but at some point they will go on display.
They'll get displayed again.
I will display them happily.
What is what's coming? What's coming?
You mean like artistically?
Well, yeah. I mean, so the podcast is ongoing.
We have some really fun stuff coming up for the holidays on the podcast, actually. Mm-hmm. We're kind of doing some specials for that.
Did you record intentionally saying this is going to come out during the holiday season? So we're going to record a holiday season episode or...
No. We haven't recorded them yet. We only record like the week before we release.
Oh, wow. Really? Okay.
Yeah. We record and then I sit and edit them and then we release them. So we're going to actually change that next year. But the format is going to change after the end of this season. And the end of this season is January. So after our like 1 year, we're going to change the format a little bit and it's going to be fun. The game that I've just released, Himbos of Myth and Metal, is a thing that I want to keep supporting. And so I'm working on a big, fun dungeon supplement for that, inspired by Delicious in Dungeon, which is a manga that is all about like the food cultures. It's like a very comedic, like taking a bunch of dungeon tropes and then being like, how do you eat it? Like there's, you know, at one point I think they cook a mimic or whatever. It's great. It's wonderful. It's just like, here's a bunch of little recipes. Here's a bunch of dudes just wandering. It's very like fun and funny and camp and silly, which is kind of the tone of the games.
Does it taste like chicken?
Right. I think that's just the question. at every moment, does it taste like chicken?
It's a mimic. It's like, well, does it taste like chicken? It's everything.
If it's mimicking a chicken, yeah, it's got to. Right. That's one of the big things. I actually just 2 days ago, released a little horror inspired photo and found poetry zine. Which is my attempt. We didn't get into this, but the pandemic really hurt my relationship to photography because I'm a portrait photographer and I haven't been seeing people for 3 years now. Yeah. Right. And so I just stopped taking photos. And I've been trying to figure out a way back into taking photos. And part of that is trying to make it individual. For my entire photographic career, it's always been like, I need other people. I need other people. I need to collaborate with them. I need the like energy back and forth. It's what I think is interesting photo. Like it's what I'm visually compelled by. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of trying to work on my way, some way to make it a solo activity. And I've just been going on photo walks, usually at night, because I think it's fun and spooky and atmospheric. And so I compiled some of those and then took a bunch of, I stole some words from public domain horror novels like Dracula and Jekyll and Hyde and all of those, and made this fun little zine that I just put out. And I think it's going to be the beginning of a regular thing, just that I have this actual, just, this is what I do. I take some photos by myself. They don't have to be great. They don't have to be perfect. I'm just going to compile them into a zine,
right.
Kind of as a way to, that's the like, oh, this is my little emotional thing I'm making. I'm trying to make a little emotional thing. Everything else is work. And then someday I'm going to release music. That's going to be a really weirder one. I'm trying to make some dungeon synth, which is a genre I didn't know existed until dungeon like synth. Earlier this year. And I love it.
It's amazing.
I mean, it's inspired by like, you know, a lot of classic movie soundtracks, like 80s fantasy music soundtracks. It's kind
right,
of
a, like the vibe. Labyrinth and
yeah, Conan and whatever. And like okay. For me, it's Xena.
Xena, really? Okay.
Oh, I love
that. Oh, yeah. I don't even know why I went. Really? Of course, Xena. Yeah. Xena, 100%.
I have a Xena tattoo. It's all that weird fantasy camp. It's my. Yeah. I'm doing a rewatch right now. It's wonderful. It's really wonderful.
I'm actually curious about the zine thing.
Yeah.
Did you produce it as a digital zine or is it a physical zine?
Both.
Okay.
One of the lovely skills of learning, like getting into RPG zines, is getting that pipeline down. Mm-hmm. It's actually like I made it this. I don't know. This is maybe a thing that's it's interesting to me. I don't know if it's interesting to other people, but like making indie RPGs is what like emboldened me to make the weird little art scene. Mm-hmm. Because so much of the mentality of indie RPGs is like, make your weird little idea, make it and release it. Maybe make it physical. Maybe just make it digital, but just do it and release it. And it might sell, but it might not. But you'll probably find some other little weirdos that are into your exact weird jam. And it has value even if it doesn't sell. Like that's just a like prevailing attitude, at least in the section of the community that I've found, is the thing that you want to make has value. So make it. How do we support you into making it? And I was like, wait, I could just apply that mentality to other things, like my relationship to photography, and I could just make it and put it out there.
Well, one of the things I hated so much, and I still do, what I hate about online selling is I fucking hate fulfilling stuff.
Yeah, no, it's wretched.
And one of the things that I decided to do, because I didn't want to be responsible for if someone were to buy a print, which is honestly one of the most gratifying moments, is to get an order for a print, is the letting someone else print it and ship it, like a drop ship service. So what I've done now is every time I think about a product or every time I think about an element, something to do, is I'm like, could I get someone else to do that for me? Like, could I, when you said, it's a physical zine as well as, did you just find a drop shipper that'll do pamphlets and like, oh, fuck it. I'm going to let someone else handle that for me.
I am doing the shipping. I did. It's such a pain in the ass. What's funny is that when I first started the zine, I was like, I'm going to do it all at home. I'm going to make it on my little printer. I'm going to go lo-fi. I'm going to staple it. It's going to look Xeroxed, whatever.
Yeah.
And then as I was designing it, I was like, I don't want to do that.
If this conversation today has given me anything, it's that you would not want to put out a Xeroxed, rough and tumbled 1990s zine.
Well, it would just look exactly perfectly like that thing. It wouldn't authentically be that. Like, I wouldn't hack it together, but it would look really hacked together.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So and I was funny. Like, no, I just would like this. And so there are two printers that I use. One is Mixem and one is Jukebox. And Jukebox is in Toronto and they're great. Right. They're just promotional pamphlets, right? They're just booklets. Yeah. But
exactly,
that's just a zine. You just change the art in there, and there. I think it's, you know, like it cost me $1.60 per to make these. Like it's not like I mean, depending on page count or whatever. But like it's usually pretty cheap to actually like produce them now, which is kind of wild to me that it like is that. Now the shipping time sucks. Shipping things just is wretched. Mm-hmm, and I also am trying to get away. I'm working with some folks to get away from having to ship my own RPG products, because there's like people out there that are working on just like being storefronts or being fulfillment centers.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of like small indie folks in RPGs that do that, which is really nice. So you have like a little retailer in Canada that's just somebody hanging out doing it, and they'll take 10 of them and make sure that they go where they need to go, or, and I love folks who do that, because it does suck. For me, I'm kind of at this weird, I'm straddling a line. And I think that if I dive deeper into it, I'll hate it less. What I hate doing is a few orders a week.
Oh my God.
Or something, right? Like if I'm doing 50, that's fine. I'll dedicate the evening. I'll put on some shows. I'll work it out.
Yep.
I'll do it. If I'm like, when I've done Kickstarter fulfillment, it's actually a little easier for me because I'm like, I'm doing a huge bucket of them. Mm-hmm. It's the like trailing or piddly ones that make it really hard. And so part of me is like, well, if I do this photo zine and I have my RPGs and I'm thinking about the podcast is thinking about making a couple merch items. And we've done some like very limited run things in the past. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, if I have enough avenues for it, I might get into fulfillment enough that it doesn't bother me. Like if I just like, oh, on Friday afternoons, I put all this stuff together or something. Yeah. I feel like that would be less bad. But individually, it's really wretched.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. I feel like I could do an episode just on how much I hate fulfillment. And, and just, I hate the fact that
I hate it.
When someone talks sucks. About it, whether or not something is fulfilling, I always think, no, it isn't. None of that is. I wish it wasn't called fulfillment because it is not, you know. Yeah,
it's just the worst.
I actually, it's, you know, it's funny, but like one of the things that I should never talk about myself, but I always do. But one of the things that I recently decided I wanted to do because I do a lot of public speaking was I want to take a stand-up comedy course.
Oh.
And when I told my brother this, he goes, "Do you want to do stand-up comedy?" And I went, "No." And he couldn't figure out that aspect of why I would take a course on stand-up comedy if I didn't want to be a stand-up comic. And I'm like, stand-up comedy is that's a thing people do. What I want to learn is to tell a story better in front of an audience. Cause I get in front of audiences all the time and I have no problem with it. But what I want to do is to be able to weave a story better. And I think a stand-up comedy is one of those things that weaves narratives very, very well. And I think it will help. I am blinded in.
Yeah, I can see that.
Like the setting sun is right there. I'm like, man, if I just, because I know we're going to be done soon. So I'm like, why would I bother shutting the fucking blind when I'm just going to hold my keyboard up to my head.
I mean, funnily enough, I mean, stand-up comedy and like improv in particular is, I know lots of people that take improv courses to play RPGs. Just because they like want to kind of sit with the craft a little bit and like learn how to talk on their feet and feel a little less uncomfortable being put on the spot or whatever.
I know business people that do Toastmasters. They do the same thing, right?
I also think like just letting people take the weird course that they think is interesting, not for its output, is great. Yeah. Right? Like I think that's a great thing to just do. You don't have to qualify why you want to take a stand-up comedy course.
I appreciate that, Max. You know, I think the thing is that I have embraced my weird for so long and just done what I want to do for so long that I am fully shocked that my younger brother would even ask, do you want to, is that a thing you want to do? But I think in his mind, if I don't have a career in mind with that, like, why would I even bother? And I'm like, dude, you have seen me do the weirdest shit for my entire life, your entire life. And all of a sudden you're wanting me to qualify why I would want to do something.
I mean, what's also funny is not like, normally, even if you did, those kinds of things make us better at our careers in ways that are not easily explainable or tangible in a way that I just don't think people who do like more normative paths understand. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But like any success that I've found, any success that Izzy has found, right. Like, and Izzy is a very successful person. Izzy is much better at success than I am. Is because we took a weird path and we followed our weird passions. And then we figured like we take a lesson from it in everything else that we do, you know, like every weird little experience that you have just because you thought it was cool will teach you something. I think it's really actually really easy with stand-up comedy to see the values of it. I actually think that's like a universal, probably it can help most people with their jobs.
Should be. I think a lot of people, I think the thing is that not a lot of people are comfortable in front of an audience. Not a lot of people. When you talk about things that you're afraid of, death and public speaking are nearly on par, which makes no sense to me, but that's because I'm a giant fucking ham and I love being in front of an audience and I love making jokes and I love trying to get people involved and, you know, I'm glad that you know what? Thank you, Max. I appreciate that. I'm going to make sure my brother listens to this episode and he hears you say, why the fuck should it matter what I want to do? Because it makes a lot of sense. And I, you know, that's going to make a lot of difference to me in the long run.
I've thought about it. I have no interest in improv, but I also am very comfortable in front of a crowd and mm-hmm. always have been. And even enjoy it. I enjoy it when I don't have to talk about things that are like academic, because they're right. Like, that's weirdly structured, but weirdly structured and meaningless, but fine. Yeah, but like the actual experience of it, I find very fun. And I have in the past been like, maybe I should take one of those courses. Maybe I should also do that, because then mm-hmm. I'll just be more on the ball. That'll be
I'm
fun.
I'm sure that Halifax has a fantastic stand-up comedy scene.
It's probably indoors with other human beings who refuse to wear a mask. Is my that's now my hesitance, right? As I'm like, just screw everyone. But someday maybe when the shots get good enough that I feel comfortable embarking in those things. But
yeah,
that's the worst. That's also such a downer to end on. The world is terrible and people's activities are dangerous.
Yeah. Shit. Oh, well, you know, trying to think of how to not, that doesn't matter. Like I'm just going to cut that out.
yeah, just not end it. Just the not wonderful ended, world of not editing. Ended Do shitty. Not end it on the world is terrible.
Yeah. The world is terrible. I think that those of us who have decided to embrace what is happening as an opportunity to do better for ourselves, to make ourselves better, as opposed to sitting and constantly looking at other people and saying, why aren't you interested in this? Mm-hmm. You know, why aren't you interested in just taking a minute? And why are you so interested in getting back out there? Why are you so interested in making the world normal again, when the world wasn't all that great when it was normal?
Yeah. Fuck. It sucked.
Yeah. It didn't suck for everybody. But it sucked for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, I'm still not understanding why we're not, let's look at this. And why are we not saying, okay, well, maybe corporate greed is a problem. Maybe we should be looking at the fact that price gouging has led to world record profits for a few companies.
Yeah. It's wild to me that there was a moment where I thought there was a moment where people were having those conversations, right? And so mm-hmm. it quickly dissipated from the public eye, and now everybody is like, yeah, YOLO, yeah. gotta go to this concert or whatever.
I had a conversation with a CEO, and it was sort of funny. We're leading into the federal election, and I said, oh my God, I really do not want the conservatives to win. Like it will be disastrous as a social experiment if the conservatives win. And he said, well, you know, it's really good for business if conservatives win, because they really put a value on business. And I'm like, but that's at devaluing human beings.
Yeah.
And it was like he and I we walked really quietly for a good long time when we both realized that we were never ever going to see eye to eye.
I also think people convince themselves that, and it's not true anymore, right? Like there is no actual statistical proof that the current conservatives
makes business any better.
Yeah, it makes the economy better, right? Like that's not a thing. And it like,
well, he didn't say the economy got better.
Yeah,
he said business got better. Yeah. So and like if you own a business, you were going to get a better ride.
Tax rates, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And all of the people that were your customers who now are destitute, that is not making business better, right? Like, it's one of those things where I'm like, yeah, you might get better tax cuts, but you're going to lose business. Mm-hmm. Like you will lose business.
But you just charge more business. And then the people that can afford to pay it will pay it, you know? And that's just how it goes right now. And you're like,
I guess I just feel like if that were true, Ontario would be thriving significantly better than it currently is, because mm-hmm. the conservatives have just been gutting everything possible. Yeah. And so every business is dying.
Yeah.
Right. Like if that were true, the proof would be in Ontario's businesses, not closing and fast and larger numbers than ever imaginable, right?
It's like crazy.
This is not even true. If it were true, we could have an argument about it. You know, like if it were true, we could talk about those.
The pros and cons.
Yeah, there would be pros and cons. Parties,
but there are no pros.
It's also just not true. There are literally no pros. You can't even say it's better for finances anymore, which like when I was growing up, that was the default, right? But like, I don't know if it was true back then. I just didn't know it wasn't true, you know? But
I know, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, it was one of those funny moments where I I just kind of realized, oh, we are never going to see eye to eye on
this. Oh, yeah, 100%.
It's just not, you've never been poor. You don't know what it's like.
It's good for business.
Can I say I'm going to let me just start that over. I really appreciated you saying, let's talk RPGs, because I knew for a fact we were not going to just talk about RPGs.
Yeah.
Like I was like, yeah, I don't know anything about them, really. Yeah. I mean, like I know about role-playing games when it comes to video games like Skyrim and whatnot. Yeah. And I dabbled in D&D for a very minimal amount of time. But it turns out I really like character creation. I do not like pretending to be a character. So it's not, I mean, that's not my jam. So I get it. I do get it on...
Funnily enough, that's not my jam either. And I play multiple role-playing games every week.
I play D&D with a group, and it was like one guy was really into it, and he was really into pretending to be the guy. And I was just my hackles were constantly going, and I was like, I want to murder you.
Yeah.
And it was like, I said, can I murder this character? And they were like, I mean, you can, it would be super weird. And I'm like, what if my character found his character annoying and wanted to murder him? And they were like, if you feel that that's what your character would, I'm like, at this moment, I want my character to want to murder that guy.
Yeah, the lines are blurry about whether or not this is the character or me, but yes. Yeah, I mean, D&D certainly has a lot of that dude. And there's a reason that I no longer really play D&D and only play other weird indie games. But I love describing what's happening and coming up with interesting, compelling prompts and problems and all that stuff. But I also am not, the thing that I keep saying about myself, is that I am dramatic and I am not theatrical.
Right.
They are different.
Well, I've started to say that everybody has a story to tell, but not everybody is a storyteller.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that probably is doubly true in the RPG world.
Oh yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, lots of people have all kinds of varieties of roles, right? Like, I don't like embodying a character a bunch, so I end up running games quite a bit. Okay. And not that people who run games don't sometimes embody characters, but it's much more, you jump around and flip between a lot of different roles, and a lot of different jobs quite a bit. And I find that much more comfortable than being a singular character. Cause yeah, I'm not theatrical. I don't want to act. I've never been, I'm comfortable speaking to other people. I'm comfortable in front of other people, but I've never been super comfortable acting. I find it really uncomfortable, to be honest.
Yeah.
And so those aren't the games that I play or make for the most part.
Well, I mean, for some people being authentic is very difficult, and they don't want to be the authentic person that they are when they're in front of people. And it's much easier to have a persona versus to be themselves. And you sound a lot like me, where it's easier to be yourself than it is to fake being someone else.
100%. I am. Also, I'm weird. That's fine. I don't like, when I think about like playing role-playing games, I'm like, I can just be a weird guy because I am a weird guy. This is not hard. I don't have to
What
act
if I
like
was a bit of a weirdo?
Yeah. The lines are always blurry with me. It's never, it's never that. But yeah, it is like there's a lot. It's part of why I kind of fell so deep into the role-playing game hole that I'm in now, is because there are so many games out there that aren't that, and so many different people making different kinds of game experience. Mm-hmm. And both from a play standpoint, but also just from a design standpoint, I find that really compelling.
I find game design super interesting. I think it's a really interesting thing. Right now I'm planning, I'm writing out a plan for an escape room, and and I know that I can't write the story of the escape room, but what I'm loving is designing puzzles, and I didn't know how much puzzles. I like designing puzzles until I started saying, oh, if I applied this thing I learned making this thing and then applied this thing I learned making this other thing, I can make a really super creative technology escape room that I have not seen or heard tell of up to this point. Yeah. And I'm really excited by this. So maybe that's a thing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if I could make my dream project, have you been to Sleep No More? Everybody likes to talk about it. It's a thing. It's in New York. It's an immersive theater event.
No.
It's
no.
It's
the house, right? It's like a building.
It's a building. But yeah, they bought a, I think they bought an old hotel. It was a life-changing experience for me. It was a life-changing experience for a lot of people I know who've been, because it was the first time that I was like, oh my God, this can exist. Like, this concept of immersive theater can be like huge and like,
right.
And genuine and compelling and actually like good and interesting. And to be honest, if I was making my dream work these days, it would be a combination like role-playing game, immersive theater, escape room thing. Like that would be where I would be if I was making, and I'm gonna try and make some of that happen, because Halifax actually has some pretty cool theater troupes that I think do immersive theater, would be open to doing immersive theater, and they do cool things. Like, they have Shakespeare in the Park. Here, it's not in the park, it's by the sea or something.
Shakespeare.
But I mean, like, it should be. Yeah.
I'm the worst. I'm an old man that has kids, so that's all bad jokes.
But usually that, like, those kinds of nerds are pretty open to like doing a thing. But I think immersive theater is cool as shit. And I think escape games are, I think the places where escape room games and immersive theater overlap is so cool. It's like my favorite thing. It's the, I don't know if you've done it yet, but the Secret City Adventures has the they do the escape rooms at the Casteloma. The Casteloma ones are cool. The one that's really cool is their Black Creek Pioneer Village one.
Okay.
That is, the puzzles are good. They have a good puzzle design. They have compelling escape rooms. Like, they're the best escape rooms that I've done in Toronto. But because it's like in Black Creek Pioneer Village, they have like this story that goes on, and you're going from building to building, and you get this like break from reality. And it's not just being locked in a room. It's bigger than that. And there's like, there is more story to them than the average escape room. And so I strongly recommend, those for that kind of experience. But I think that there's like, I think it's just one of the rare spaces in games where there is so much more to actually happen that we haven't figured out yet. And that's not like true for a lot of games. Like, even RPGs, we're mainly just stealing ideas from one another and putting different skins on it and like having a different flow of things, which does change the gameplay, but it's not like hugely innovative, you know? Like, it's not like, oh, we're really changing the shape of the landscape. That's not really happening. And I don't think that's happening with most video game design. In some places there's some cool stuff happening, but I think there's just been so much video game design that it's hard to come up with novel ideas. And I think in this weird like transmedia theater performance art, like, I think it's way more compelling than anything VR has ever did, and they put way too much money into VR as a VR developer. as the thing that has mostly paid my bills for the last couple of years being VR development, VR is kind of a joke, and people like to throw around the like immersive tag a lot.
Right.
For it being a digitally immersive experience, and it's just so much less cool than what can be done IRL, and we just aren't exploring it, and not a lot of places are exploring it as a design space, and I think it's super compelling.
Max, I have really enjoyed this conversation, and I want to thank you again for volunteering to be on the episode, and I really feel like I've learned so much about what you're up to and your processes and the things that you find cool. And I can't thank you enough.
Yeah. I mean, thanks for having me. This has been a hoot. A hoot, a whole hoot.
A whole hoot.
I sound ancient.
Just a hoot. Okay.
Yeah. Not just one hoot, a whole hoot.
This episode of Can't Sell This was produced in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. All creative content in this episode is copyright Hugh Elliott and Stefan Grambart. Questions or comments can be emailed to admin@cantsellthispodcast.com. Music for the podcast is provided by Not Of. Find Not Of at notof.bandcamp.com. Opening and closing voiceover provided by jeffwright.ca. If you enjoyed this episode, a like in whatever platform you use goes a long way to helping the podcast get noticed. Thanks for listening, and keep creating.
It was you.